How did you get your start as a countertenor?
I think being a countertenor is something that you you get a choice to do, actually. There's a physiological thing when voices break. My voice broke quite late when I was 16, 17. But instead of just suddenly snapping overnight kind of thing, and I didn't go through this period where I couldn't really control my voice like that, the voice just kind of slid down. And I distinctly remember this period when I was 16, 17, where I could sing bottom bass and I could sing the top treble and sort of everything in between. And then it just took years, a few years later, for the range to just settle down. And it really was a question. I was lucky enough to have a singing teacher at the time. It was a question of whether I wanted to move the broken voice, the chest voice, up and then sort of get into a baritone register, or keep singing high as I always did as a boy, and just push the break down a bit. And I chose to do what I'd always done. It felt the most natural. When I sang baritone, for example, I just different parts of the body resonate. It just felt a bit weird, to be honest. So I just kept on singing high, and it just settled into this alto range, and I can only say it's the most natural thing I've ever done.
Now, is it something that you have to really start honing while it's happening, during that time of the initial voice change? Because I remember when my voice changed, I went through puberty kind of early. I went like right around 13 or 14. Yeah. Well, to the point where like people were seeing my 5 o'clock shadow wondering how long I was in school. So, yeah, you know, yeah. But I mean, my voice went way up and way down, and it just crackled all over the place, and I couldn't do any, I felt like I couldn't do anything about it. So how did you do something about it initially at the time? And when did you realize that you could control it?
Well, I think initially when we're all teenagers, we don't really want to do things. And so you're in school and people want you to do choir after school. We had a choir practice which went on past detention, I remember. And I thought, oh God, I really can't be doing this. So you can use it as a teenager, use it as an excuse to do nothing if you want. But you can work on it if you're motivated enough. I mean, I can't say that I was, but I think if you are motivated as a teenager enough, you can absolutely tackle it head on. You just work very gently on that break area. And it's just like any exercise, you have to train the muscles a little bit, and it's like going to the gym. You just do a few exercises every day, and nothing too much. But if you don't want to, if that's not really for you, you can. Your body will naturally sort itself out, and you can tackle it a little bit later, maybe when you're 20, something like that. So it's not really. There's no hard and fast rule as to how to train your voice in that sense, because when you're young, you're going through so many physical changes anyway. You can either do it while you're changing, or wait till all the physiological changes have already taken place. So I think your larynx keeps on growing until you're about 27, I read somewhere. So there's no real rush when you're in your teens to start hammering through many exercises and turning something which we should all be able to do naturally into something which is just a little bit dull and like a chore. The first things first is do what you want to do, because you've got to be able to enjoy it.
So that's the time when you figure out what type of voice what type of singing voice you want to go for.
Yeah, you can, as I say, you can have this choice as to whether, if your voice slides down, you can have this choice whether you want to sing baritone and push the broken range up, or carry on singing high and push the broken range down, because it's around the middle C, so the middle of the piano kind of area where countertenors tend to be quite weak, and as a young tenor, you tend to be quite strained as well. So there are different ways of approaching the notes, different ways of using the muscles to create those notes and create that sound. It is a little bit of a choice, but then on the other hand, your voice ends up going in a direction you want to do. I remember I wanted to get into the pop world, but suddenly realized that as my voice was going into this kind of higher range, that I thought, well, fair enough, let's go with it. And then when I retrained retrained. I went to one of the London conservatories. I went to Guildhall, and there I thought, I'm going to probably be work with small historically informed period bands or something like that. And then my teacher said, no, this is going in an operatic direction, and there's nothing really you can do about it. This is the way your voice is going to grow and develop. So go with it.
Now, did you fall in love with opera right away, or was it something that you fell in love with as you learned about it?
I think it was something that I wanted to tackle. Let's see if I make myself clear. I grew up in a theatrical background. My dad was an actor. My parents met in the theatre when they were stage managers at the Repertory Theatre in Portsmouth. And so all my life I've grown up with being around actors, being in the theatre, going to the theatre quite a lot. I kind of love that naturalistic way of presenting a story. And I did have a very early experience of working in opera when I was 13. I was very lucky enough to get chosen by English National Opera to sing in Venice in a Benjamin Britten opera called Turn the Screw, and that was just as a boy treble. There was a specific vocal quality that they wanted, and that you can only get from an unbroken voice. And so I had that, but that was dreamland. I never really thought it was going to be a career for me, that singing was going to be a career. But when I did come into it, I thought, okay, fine. There are a lot of things in opera which I want to challenge. And one of those things is to approach it from an actor's point of view, and use the voice in an acting way that really gets to your emotions, as well as physically. Being on stage, you have to convince people that you are the person that you're playing. So I'm kind of coming to opera slightly reluctantly and slightly apprehensively, but I've now been doing this for almost 10 years, and I have to say it's one of the nicest places to work.
Now, and you have to be an actor as well, because operas are plays for the most part set to music. I mean, for the layperson, I remember when I was a kid, my parents wanted to took me to an opera. We went to visit New York, and I thought, oh, this is going to suck. Because I was 12 and stuff. And we saw Curlew River. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I haven't, but
I thought it was gorgeous. I was completely enthralled. There were elements of cathedral music. The harmonies just really took me. And I think I know what you're talking about when you talk about, getting the correct vibrations in your body, because there were points in that opera where I could actually feel the voices, for lack of a better term, you know, in my chest.
This is exactly what happens. I mean, there is a sort of sympathetic resonance that happens with the audience. This is a live medium. We really need. I know it's ridiculous talking about a recording, but yeah, it's generally a live medium. You have to be there in the room, experiencing these singers singing at you full pelt, because your body does respond, and you do find yourself resonating. But then, of course, you find yourself being moved emotionally as well, because that has a sympathetic reaction too. So yeah, you're absolutely right on the nail. And it was great age to start. I'd say 12 is you know who you are. You know, you're at that age where, as you say, you were prejudging, and then suddenly you're faced with something which you never knew existed. And yeah, like any teenager, you're going to react and go, wow, that's I've got to know.
Yes, and around the same time was when Luciano Pavarotti was becoming famous here in America to the mainstream. And
sure.
So, I mean, I started getting into him and Panini and all that other stuff. I mean, they were like, you know, how, like, it's funny because some people, you know, other people my age had Jane's Addiction and Red Hot Chili Peppers in their secret collection. I had Pavarotti in mine, you know, so I can fully understand what you're talking about. But with what I'm talking about the chest resonance, is that what you get as the singer as well? Do you feel parts of your body resonate as you're singing?
You absolutely do. If you're not feeling that, then you know you're not projecting. I mean, it's a tough technique that you have to develop over years. But then you think of what forces you're working against. You don't have a microphone, and yet you've got a full almost symphony orchestra in the pit below you. You've got a massive chorus behind you singing, and you've somehow, your one voice has to somehow cut through all of that. And so you develop a technique which does involve pretty much every part of your body. It is necessarily a physical activity. Your body, different parts of you resonate, and you work on trying to get these head resonance to project. It's almost using your entire head as the bell of a trumpet to project the sound forward. So yeah, absolutely.
And it's kind of spiritual too.
I think, well, this is one thing when people tell me that they can't sing, I just have to say that almost means you're not a human being in a way, or that's what you're denying yourself. Because, you know, wherever you go, if you go to the football match, you go to rugby, wherever, when you hear an entire group of people singing together, there is such a wonderful expression. I hate the word humanity, but it is. There's a wonderful expression of self that comes from just a simple act of singing and saying, telling the other side, this is who we are, kind of thing. It is a very necessary activity. Everyone can do it. And of course, it becomes a spiritual thing, especially in a group like that. And no one can go to a sports match and say that's not somehow a spiritual experience when you're absolutely behind your team and you get through everything.
Well, and also, another example would be when you're at a concert, you know, for a really popular act, and we've all seen this happen where the lead singer will let the crowd take over.
Yeah, that's really sweet. I wish I could do that myself. There's not that convention in the classical world, which actually slightly annoys me, because you have such knowledgeable audiences these days that they probably can come along and hum along to it, to that kind of thing. But it is that idea of we are all in this together. It's a live performance, and the audience is as much part of that performance in a way, because of the way they respond, because of the way they feel. And that's what makes performing live so exciting, because you don't do that every day. You do that when it feels right for the audience, kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Now you've played in front of some pretty significant audiences yourself. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, as I said, I've been doing this. This is my coming towards the end of my ninth year of being a professional now, of singing solo principal roles on the opera stage. I've worked for some fantastic opera companies across Europe, from the English National Opera to Stuttgart to Karlsruhe to across Amsterdam and in Switzerland. As a singer, you get different platforms. So that's one thing. You also get the concert stage, and there are some wonderful concert halls. So here in London, where I'm based, we've got the Queen Elizabeth Hall and the Royal Festival Hall, where I've performed. But also in I think probably one of my favorite one was in Amsterdam, where they have the Concertgebouw, which is an astonishing hall. Really, really exciting programs they have every year, and a great honor to be able to do the odd concert there once or twice. So yeah, I've had a very nice, lucky ride in many ways. It never feels it like the time. At the time, you think, oh, that could always get a little bit more in my diary, kind of thing. But I've had a wonderful experience of singing to very different audiences. There is a different personality. Anyone that tours different countries, whether it's a rock artist or a classical artist, they will know that if you're performing in Berlin, there is a very different vibe to when you're performing in London. And you get to learn a little bit about the place you're in by the response from the audience. It's a fascinating experience.
I totally agree. As an observer and an audience attender, that makes me want to ask you. Like I said, I remember when I saw Curlew River, it was at the Met, the Metropolitan Opera House in New York, and the acoustics were just phenomenal. How is it as a participant in the opera? For lack of a better term, what are the acoustics like being in the show as opposed to being an observer? Because you're immersed in it. You're like in the middle of the music.
Well, yeah, sometimes it's the best place to be, absolutely. And I particularly like that in concert forms. If I'm on the concert platform, then you've got the entire orchestra are pretty much right there behind you. And it's a wonderful feeling. It is kind of the best seat in the house. But then there are other opportunities when you've got to tell the story. If particularly in opera, there are many more barriers to the sound, in a sense. And the job is really to project that sound out into the hall, into the auditorium. So you do actually sometimes find yourself just trusting it a little bit, because there might be a stage in the way, or there's a noise that you can't quite hear. You need to get some fold back onto the stage. Sometimes you get microphones into the pit, the orchestral pit, so you can hear a little bit of fold back, so you know what you're accompanying. It's very difficult also with different distances that you're working with. You can be at the back of the stage, and then you've got an orchestra, of course, right next to the front row of the stalls. So there's sometimes a time lag which you have to adjust to, and you feel like you're singing sort of fast or too soon to what you can hear. And there is a little bit of professionalism that comes into it, where you rely on the music staff to tell you, actually, no, this bit's a little bit behind, this bit could have a better balance, you can be louder or softer here, because sometimes it is true that you can't hear what you're doing in terms of the whole that's coming out into the auditorium. But in general, and yeah, it is that is those are very few times when that happens. It does happen more often than I would like, but most of the time it's fortunately for me, it's the other option, which is that you're in the best seat of the house.
Nice. I mean, now what is the pressure like doing a structured show like that? Because that was one of the main things I've been thinking about, you know, when I asked Natasha for this interview, and it always astonished me how structured an opera is. Like my band, the only structure we have is a song list, and we go away from that all the time. I mean, but you guys are note for note every night.
You pretty much have to be a note for note, and that goes down to a huge rehearsal program that goes on. I'm actually end of next week. I'm back off to Germany in Stuttgart, reviving a show that I did there 2 years ago, and we've only got maybe 3 weeks to get this back on track. And the show is Peter Pan, so I'm being Peter Pan, and you can think of all the technical elements of that, where you've got to fly, and it's a different routine, and there's all the danger elements in that, and you've got to remember an entire show in 3 weeks, because come the 13th of December, that is when the curtain goes up and you've got to be on it, kind of thing. So yeah, there is a lot of pressure, but fortunately there is a whole team that goes behind you to make sure that you're there. I say we've only got 3 weeks, but we're going to be using all the time, and if there's any moment of danger or a bit of not being sure about things, then yeah, you make sure you have the rehearsal time to sort it out.
Well, and Peter Pan on top of the pressure of the structure, you've got the pressure of the legacy.
Because
that's I mean, Peter Pan is pretty legendary itself as a story.
It's a heritage piece. It's a heritage piece, particularly in the UK, I would have thought, but actually in the States as well. It's something which exists in so many different guises, from cartoon, full feature film, on the stage. It existed as an original play that's gone into musical. It's gone into pantomime. It's gone into ballet. It's got so many different ways of retelling this story. I was actually surprised when the job came through that this hasn't actually been done on the opera stage before, and it's then no surprise that it's taken off, and that's why I'm going back to revive it, because everyone loves the story, but yeah, it was never given the opera treatment before, and there are certain things which you can do that perhaps you can't necessarily do in other art forms that you really can invest in the opera rendition of it.
Well, exactly. And I'm surprised. I didn't know that until you just said that it's never been done as an opera before. It's been done. I mean, Hollywood tackles Peter Pan every 10 years or so.
I know. And there's so much in the, I mean, as an artist playing the title role, you realize that there's so much information that's not in a lot of these Hollywood films that go through it. And you think, oh, wow, that's I think that's really important for people to know about this character, this little bit of information, which is left out because it doesn't quite fit in with this story. But then it just makes for me, it just makes the character more three-dimensional. And I want that information. I want people to know about that. So, again, that's another thing. When you're revisiting it, you can sort of insist on saying, no, we really need to do this. I know it's a little bit uncomfortable, but we need to portray all the flaws as well as the good fun things.
Mm-hmm. Now, when and where does the operatic rendition of Peter Pan start?
That starts in Stuttgart on the 13th of December. I've just this year done the English language version, which was done with Welsh National Opera. That happened in the spring and had a little tour to the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden in London, in July. But that was a completely different production. This is the original German production in German, with a very, very ambitious flight rig to get the effects going. We have this amazing bungee jump on a pivot in the middle of it, and all I do is sort of hold on to a bit of scenery. They pull in the tension, and then I just spring into the air, and then it's all down to me getting my precise jumps, hitting my marks in order to sort of make the flying visible. It's a really exciting, epic show, and I don't use the word epic lightly, because it really does have that cinematic feel to it. It starts right at the time when the Christmas market in Germany, in Stuttgart, is opening. It goes from the 13th right through to the 5th of January. So all through the Christmas period, it's going to be fantastic.
Now, do you find when I hear opera, and I hear opera in English, German, or Italian, or even French, I find that the German and the Italian versions sound beautiful. I mean, I don't speak Italian and I don't speak German, but it's just the syntax structure.
It is. There are different ways of looking at languages. I always think that Italian feels like a sequence of vowels where you just have to drop the consonants onto the sentences. The consonants are almost interrupting the sound, and the sound is just a constant line. It's one of the things they always try and teach you in college, is to really get this legato line, this seamless sound, and just sort of drop your consonants on the line as you're going along. But German, German, I find a little bit closer to English in a way, because we have as many consonants in German as you do in English. The vowels are quite similar to the English vowels as well. But I can hear my teacher telling me off as soon as I'm talking about this, because he would say, no, always sing it like Italian. Try and get the sound out first. But I go back to the fact that I'm an actor and I want people to understand it. And if you can't get the text, then I don't feel I'm doing my job in a way. I always have this internal fight to get people to understand it, or otherwise it's, as you say, it's just this beautiful sound, and then you go, well, so what? I need a story too. I need something to link this to.
Well, and as an actor, isn't one of the prime lessons of an actor is that the text is always the narration, no matter what.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. You have a story to tell. There's no point going to a story and not getting and only getting the sound, getting the emotion behind the narrative. You need the story there too, because that takes you on the adventure as well.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about your EP. That's coming out this month.
That's coming out on the 27th, I think, is the last I heard, 27th November. But this was a long running project that I've had in my head, in the back burner for quite some time. And it was galvanized, I suppose, back in 2011 when I did a concert in London for the London Song Festival, run by a fantastic pianist and accompanist called Nigel Foster. He invited me to do this concert of English song, and I thought, fantastic. This is not, it was almost the first time that I wasn't asked to do the very early songs, the Dowland, the Purcell, those sorts of early to late 17th century English songs. He was very adamant, this is a piano recital, we need 19th century repertoire. He'd seen me in one of my previous concerts, and he really liked my text and my ability to tell stories in English. And so he invited me along to this and actually introduced me. I came along with many ideas, but he introduced me to a whole range of repertoire because he's sort of encyclopedic knowledge of the song list. And yeah, we had a wonderful, wonderful time. And I thought, from then, I thought we really have to record this one day, because there aren't many cantatenors who are recording this repertoire, this particularly this style of music. More than that, actually, a lot of the songs which I plan to do in a much larger album aren't really known at all, but we know the composers. There's a fantastic composer called Hubert Parry, who people will only know from The Royal Wedding, for example, that was played at Will and Kate's wedding, one of his church anthems. But they don't realize that he's also a very good songwriter, just for the simple voice and piano setup, and a really, really lovely, rich, emotionally involved, romantic performance is required from his songs. But he really writes very well for the voice. No one really knows that his song output, because they only know his church writing, because he was a church organist himself. There's lots for the listener to enjoy and to discover, whilst albeit in a style that they would probably recognize. It's being delivered by a voice type that they expect to hear singing much earlier music, and yet it's a voice that has grown. It exists as a presence on the opera stage now. It has a lot more emotional content than they would probably imagine, and so it's definitely an more than a curiosity. I'd say it was a necessary listening bit in your library.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds amazing. Like I said, we were talking earlier about Full Fathom 5. I mean, I love the.
We put that out as a little taster. That's available on the SoundCloud.
Exactly. And it sounds like a. I would say, I mean, it sounds like a marriage between, you know, instrument and beauty.
It has to be that. You again, it goes back to the actor. You're using your voice as an actor, as a storyteller. It's not the simple element of putting an emotion on a sound. You've got to really be inside those songs. The Full Fathom 5, which is available at the moment, is an interesting one, because that itself was a curiosity. It was written in it was written for a Shakespeare production, a production of The Tempest in the Old Vic in 1962, I think it was, by Michael Tippett, and it was designed to be sung on stage. May or may not be designed to be sung on stage by an actor. It could have been a different range. It could be sung in tenor. It's a very funny range. It's a difficult one, and it's a very difficult one for. To really say this has to go for this voice type or this voice. It was just generally thought of for a character, and the character Puck is particularly singing this song. He's a nymph. He's a really sort of playful and slightly spiteful nymph, and you have that all of that writing in the music. You have to perform it, and I found myself in front of the microphone thinking, no, you've got to really you've got to be professional about this. Keep your distance from the microphone the right way. Don't move around too much. All of those things were coming through your head, but you do really need to live the songs, absolutely, to deliver what they're saying. It was a very interesting discipline to be involved in.
It's good that you bring up mic positioning and everything else, because I was going to ask you about the acoustics of the sessions, because like I said, I heard Full Fathom 5. That almost sounds like a stage recording itself.
Well, again, you need to do a faithful recording. As soon as we got into the studio, we had a microphone set up in a different booth, and the piano was in a different booth. And I thought, no. This is a classical recording. We, for the integrity of the performance, we need to be in the same room for a start, and then you need to just take the recording from that. And the producer, who hadn't actually worked with me before, was slightly alarmed and sort of like, you do realize, Justin, you've got to get it right if you do that, because I can't play with auto-tune. I can't do anything like that. And I said, no, if I can't do it in one take, I'm not doing my job. So
let's, you know. Well, yeah, because the tracks are going to bleed. You're going to go into the piano and the
throat. Do it. And a lot of these songs, it is the conversation between the piano and the voice. I'm really pleased you picked up that it is a marriage between instrument and beauty, because you have to talk. I mentioned Nigel Foster, who was the guy that introduced me to the in London Song Festival. He was the guy playing on the EP because we'd already had this relationship working together before. It was a no-brainer. I had to get him involved in the project as well. And you do need that conversation in the room, and that's what you need to record. So I can only say it has to be a true, faithful recording that you're going to produce if you're going to achieve what you want from the song.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's funny because I have my own mini studio, I guess you could say. It's like a studio that's in part of my house that I wasn't using until I did that. But it's great because, you know, like studio, you know, track bleed is something I always try to avoid, but in this case it's necessary.
Exactly. Yeah, you've got to have, as you say, different parts resonate. You've got to have that conversation of resonance. You've got to have that harmonic conversation in the room. It's something which it's not that you whether it's inevitable, whether you want it, but I mean, what you want is to feel like you're in the room when it's happening.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. They're not microphones anymore. They're ears.
Exactly. That's it. There's nothing. I very rarely work on projects where I have amplification. Sometimes it happens, but you want the microphones like a radio's microphone. You're just picking up the sound that's there in the room.
Mm-hmm. Now, are the other songs like that as well?
I try to keep them very varied. They vary from extremely emotional, and I'm you know, tentatively before I did it, I thought maybe this is a little bit too much for a first EP or whatever. But no, you always have to back your instincts, and it made sense within the programming. All the songs, they do have a little a running thread, I suppose. They were all written, as I say, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, by fantastic English composers. But they were all setting texts which were written in this very small, very short period of history, the Jacobean period. Just at the end of Queen Elizabeth I's reign. And there is oddly a very interesting marriage of sentiment between the Jacobean poet and the 19th century romantic English composer. It's somehow a collaboration separated by 250 years, which absolutely goes together. It makes my job really difficult because initially when you read the poetry alone, you think this is really sentimental and it just doesn't quite gel in a modern way. But then you look at the music and you think similarly, oh, this is a little bit schmaltzy. Maybe I don't want this to be too naff and all that. You have all these self-doubts that go in, but then you put the two together. And it's absolutely fantastic. You just have to go with it 100%, unashamedly deliver what the song is asking. And then these songs really, really work and they really fly.
Now, where do you... one question I always love to ask when somebody does such a unique piece like this is... how do you think you might look back on this 5 years from now when you hear it again?
Well, I suppose I grew up. That's a very good question. When I was growing up, I grew up in possibly the heyday of classical recording, where every band was producing the definitive rendition of such and such. Name that symphony. You know, they were saying that all through the 80s, they were producing the definitive, the last thing. A lot of these recordings haven't actually stood the test of time. It was just a wonderful way of getting records out and getting people buying them and putting them in the libraries, I sometimes feel. However, there are some which really do stand the test of time, and they are the ones that have all the elements that we're talking about today. I think if I look back on this project, I would definitely be proud of the product. Whether my view will have changed about some of the songs, I don't know. I hope it will, because as a performer, you're always going to change your mind about what certain songs mean and choosing your route through the songs. But I actually hope that it will. I'd be very proud that it will prick people's ears up a little bit, make them rethink about the voice. And I hope, and actually, in 5 years' time, I'll be on, having done an English project, I'd be on to my second love, which is Russian song. So maybe I'll be on to my second album and opening people's ears up to Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky.
Oh, nice, nice. So, and the Russian language is another language that has very good syntax, in my opinion. I mean, it's a language that just flows.
But not even that. It's just so wonderful for the voice. It opens out the voice into a much bigger, darker space that somehow channels a completely different emotional stream. It's a really interesting experience singing in Russian. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I was introduced to it right back in conservatory when I was retraining. I had a fantastic, she was Czech actually, I had a fantastic Russian coach, but the Czech pianist, Lada Valesova, who's just brought out a wonderful Czech piano recital album. She had an undersubscribed Russian song class, and so I had 3 hours of training every week, one-on-one. It was just brilliant, and so from that I not only expanded my technique but I expanded my repertoire, and no one has actually recorded these songs. No countertenor has recorded these songs, and so that again would be another first.
Now, are you an actual multilingualist, or do you learn these languages phonetically?
When you start, you have to learn them phonetically. I do speak four languages. The German one came along a little bit late. I learned that I went to night school and learned that just because I was working so much abroad in Germany and Switzerland. I realized it's just that you can, of course, international opera houses, they do always work in English. That's just a given. But you have to live there for 10 weeks when you're doing the project, and it just makes life a lot more fun and enjoyable if you do speak a little bit.
Yeah, just to go out on the street for a couple hours.
Yeah, exactly. you got to do that. I did get the German sorted out, and again that opens a few doors. When I did Peter Pan the first time round, we had to do a few television interviews. My German was just able to cope with that, as long as I was on that topic talking about what I knew. That's been 3 years later. I'm pretty much comfortable with that. But no, I don't speak Russian. I don't know whether I ever will. Your question about whether you have to learn a song phonetically or not, I think you do. You have to learn the song. You need to know exactly what you're saying, what it is word for word, what each word means. It's not actually necessary to speak the language in order to deliver the truth behind a song. The example in German is there are so many declensions as to whether it's accusative, whether it's dative. Essentially, the word is the. It's the definite article, and it can be der, dem, den, anything. It doesn't really matter. It is still in your head. You are still saying the something. With the best intention, it's not really necessary to be able to speak it, but you do need to know exactly what it means. Having said that, now I speak German, and I realize this is accusative, this is going towards the direct object. I know that sounds all very technical, but it does actually affect your thought process, because it gets you closer to the poet that wrote the text in the first place. And that will absolutely affect your performance, and it'll come through to the audience ultimately as well. But that's what I mean about your mind changing about this repertoire. You will do it one day, and this is what I think about this song today. 5 years down the line, you'll be thinking, well, actually, that's a very interesting turn of the phrase. I can see he's heading towards a different direction. Whilst the music is going in one direction, the poet wants to go take the story in a different one, and then you can actually enjoy that tension between the two.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's amazing, too, because what you're talking about, you know, with different terms of the, is they're basically what we would do in English is spelling out different inflections.
Exactly. You are essentially sort of riding a wave of the natural melody of the sentence. If you don't know where it's going, you have to rely on the composer's understanding of the language, and you go absolutely with the music. If you start to see these moments where there is a conversation between the composer and the writer, And you see the, as I said, the poet wants to go in one direction, and you can see the tide going off to the left. But the composer is deliberately saying, no, that I want this to be a calm passage, and I don't want and then you have this lovely tension between the turbulence of the language and then the serenity of the music, and you can do something with that as an artist. It's very useful.
Mm-hmm. Now, where can we find you online?
I exist on Facebook. I exist at yestin.com is my current website. You can also find a lot of clips on YouTube. If you just search my name, Yestin Morris, there's quite a few of those to be had. Of course, the EP is coming out. It's very much a well, I suppose it's not very much a new thing, but it feels a new thing to suddenly think, oh, actually, I could really increase my discography, because I've been such a live artist up until now. I really think that I could probably do a little bit more and get a few more, dig out a few of my old DVDs that have been made of performances. And that's the thing. I have a discography, but it's always been a live take of a performance. But having said that, I can get some of those out on the YouTube at some point. If you Google me, it's very easy to find. There's
quite a lot out there. Now, do you plan on expanding your discography legitimately in the future with another EP or a full album?
Absolutely. That's always been the plan. This is the first step in, as I say, a many step process. I want to do a much bigger English album. I want to do then take it onto a Russian song album, and then we'll see where we're going from there. We're looking to get enough interest from the EP to convince the record company or whoever to take it on board.
Nice. And then this EP comes out November 27th.
That's what I've last been told. Yes, I think so.
Nice. Well, thank you for being on the show today, Yestin. I really appreciate it. You are an amazing talent and a magnificent performer. And I hope to see you live here in the States pretty soon.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been great.